This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name's David Inch. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Jack Brighton, Harriet Williamson, Brian Wagner at the controls this morning. Just a quick mention that tomorrow morning on the program, both hours of the show, one way and another, we'll be dealing with astronomy. In the first part of the program, we'll be talking with Kim Melville, his professor of astrophysical and planetary sciences at University of Colorado at Boulder. He'll be visiting the campus here, and we'll be talking about astronomy in both ancient and modern cultures. And then in the second hour, we'll talk about things that you can see in the sky this time of year. And our guest will be John Dickel. He is professor of astronomy at the University of Illinois. So any questions you have about astronomy, space exploration, these are the times to check those things out and give us a call. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week and always invite you to call if you have questions. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with novelist Michael Chabon. And we'll be talking about his most recent book, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 2000, and it has been out now for a couple of months in paperback. The title of his book is The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which is about two cousins, Joe Cavalier and Sam Clay, who are thrown together in the years before World War II. And together play an important role in the golden era of the comic book. It's a really fine book. I would certainly recommend it. I enjoyed it a lot. It's published by Picador, the paperback edition published by Picador, and you can find it in bookstore now, I'm sure. Michael Chabon is the author of several other books, including Werewolves in Their Youth, Wonder Boys, A Model World and Other Stories, and Mysteries of Pittsburgh. He makes his home in California. This book also, by the way, Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, won the Bay Area Book Reviewers Award, the New York Society Library Award. It was a finalist for the Pan Faulkner Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award and the L.A. Times Book Award. He, by the way, is going to be in this part of the country for couple of events coming up this weekend. On the 11th Sunday, as part of the Chicago Humanities Festival, at 11 o'clock in the morning, a conversation with Jonathan Franzen. This takes place at the Newberry Library. And then also he'll be taking part in a panel discussion that will take place at the Thorne Library at Northwestern University, same day, 3:30 in the afternoon. So people who are listening to us this morning in Chicago could take the opportunity to hear from him. And of course, here on the program, anybody who would like to call in is welcome to do that. Questions are welcome. All we ask is people just, you know, try to be brief if you can to keep things moving along. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Chabon, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Nice to be here.
I appreciate it very much. And I thought it was a terrific book. I enjoyed it very, very much. So I'm glad that you could talk with us about it. Well, perhaps we should start out, and I would ask you to talk a little bit about your characters, Sam Clay, Joe Cavalier, these two cousins. Sam Clay, born in Brooklyn, his cousin Joe, born in Prague, who are thrown together quite suddenly on the eve of World War II?
Well, I'd be happy to. They are, as you say, they're cousins. Sam Clay is a Brooklyn kid. He is a child of immigrants. He has grown up in a world of the Great Depression and pulp magazines and the kind of myth of the self-made man. And all of this stuff is swirling around in his brain and his imagination. And he's at the age of 19. He's already beginning to feel like he may have, you know, sort of missed his opportunity to make it big, and above all, to get out of Brooklyn, which is his major goal. And sort of the barrier of the East River seems sometimes like kind of an insurmountable barrier to him. And what he really wants, of course, is to you know, be the master of an empire in a tall building in Manhattan. And when his cousin, Joe Cavalier, a refugee from Nazi-occupied Prague, who's about a year older than he is, and is in possession of some special abilities, among them the ability to draw beautifully and training in the art of escape that he received as a kid when he was interested in magic. He seizes upon Joe and Joe's abilities and sort of, in a way, Joe's, you might almost say his alter ego, to come up with this idea for a comic book superhero at a period when the comic book is just beginning to leap onto the popular culture stage and to rise to prominence. And Sam correctly sees comics as a going thing that is going to get even bigger than it already is. And he sees Joe also correctly as his means to kind of conquer this world, because he's got the ideas and Joe's got the drawing hand, and together they're going to, you know, really make it big. And, yeah. And at least that's the plan at the beginning.
Now, well, they make a great match because, as you say, Sam, he has the ability to come up with these ideas and plots, but it's really clear that he's not a great artist.
No.
His cousin, though, is.
Yeah.
And when he sees just how brilliant his drawing is, then Sam starts spinning out this idea of how it is that they can make it big in comics. And
right.
Joe, of course, doesn't know anything. He doesn't know from comics, but gets the sense his the sort of excitement of his cousin is so infectious, it gets
right.
him too. And he has managed to get out of Czechoslovakia, the one member of his family who gets out. And the idea is that, or the hope is that, perhaps some of his, once he gets to the United States, maybe he can get some of his other family members out. So he has to find some way to get himself established and to make some money.
Exactly.
And so his this plan, this plot of his cousins that perhaps he doesn't completely understand, seems like, well, this could be the way to do it. And so they embark on this project to create this comic.
Exactly. Joe Cavalier's motives are somewhat less, I don't know what you call them. Let's just say there has a certain nobility to them, in that he is trying to fund his family's escape, and that's the reason he's so driven to get a job and to make money and to put money away. And it's also the reason why he's so willing to listen to this kid that he barely knows. Who begins to sing this kind of siren song, and the reason that Joe is so just eagerly kind of latches onto it is because his need is so true and so desperate.
The two of them together, they develop this character that seems to be sort of equal parts Superman and Harry Houdini, that they call the Escapist.
Yes, the Escapist.
And yeah, it's definitely definitely reflects Joe Cavalier's experiences and interest in magic and in being an escape artist.
Right, yeah. He's a super-powered escape artist. Although, actually, at the beginning, as initially conceived, he has no superpowers. He is just a highly trained escape artist. Mm. But when this becomes insufficient, when this power proves to be insufficient for dealing the kind of destruction and death to the Axis powers that Sammy and Joe both come to feel that they need to dish out, then the escapist's powers are sort of amped up, and he does become super powerful in a way like Superman or Captain America. But yeah, he reflects Joe Cavalier to some degree. He also reflects Sam Clay, his other father, in that his alter ego of Tom Mayflower. He is the escapist is lame in one leg and walks on crutches, and it's only when clutching this sort of magical object, this golden key, that he has these powers. And that reflects Sam, in that Sam was suffered from polio as a child and has been left with withered legs. And although he doesn't need crutches, he has a kind of a halting gait. And so, I mean, you have elements of both of them sort of swirling into this character that they create. And I think, you know, that's often true with some of the most interesting, not simply comic book characters, but characters in general in different kinds of fiction, is when elements of the creators work their way into the characters. Then even in a kind of crass sort of popular genre, you can get some very interesting results. And I think that's what happens with The Escapist. Mm.
It points to what is an important theme that runs all the way through the book and plays out in various ways, and most of them we will not talk about, So we will leave that for people to discover who will want to read the book. I don't want to tell the complete story of the book. But very clearly, an important theme is escape, is liberation. That, for example, you talked about the fact that Sam, his big goal was to get out of Brooklyn and really make it, be someone. And of course, Joe, one of the first things that we see him do in the book is he escapes.
Right.
He gets out of Europe.
Yes.
And so all through the book, people are doing this. So I'm wondering, why was it that you seized on that? What about the idea of escape or liberation interest you?
Well, it just emerged from the material, from the characters themselves. I mean, I began with the idea of writing something that would be set during the so-called golden age of comic books in the late 30s through the early 1950s, a period that interested me, an art form that interested me. And then I moved to creating the characters of Sammy and Joe, and their backgrounds and their personalities began to emerge fairly quickly as soon as I started to write about them. And it was just in following them and their interaction and their story and their histories and so on that this idea of escape just began to emerge as a theme of the book. It was not a deliberate or conscious thing. And in fact, I didn't even really notice it at first. And it wasn't until I began work, I think, on the second draft of the book that in looking over it, I saw, wow, I've got this whole thing with, I mentioned Houdini here. I hadn't really made all that much of it yet. And I have alluded to this other escape artistry stuff. And I wonder, looking at the fact that Joe gets out of Prague and so on, I wonder if there's some kind of connection here between the idea of literal escape, whether it's, you know, a stage magic kind of escape from chains and crates or a real escape from an occupied city under tyranny, and the other kind of escape, the kind of escape that I haven't really been paying that much attention to yet, but which has always been understood to be a kind of an integral part of what comic book reading is all about, certainly. And in fact, one of the greatest charges that have been leveled against comic books over the years, especially in their early days, was that they were mere escapist reading, that they were, you know, they all they did was provide an easy escape from reality. And suddenly, when I had that thought, things just really kind of clicked together. I could hear it sort of snapping into place. And then in subsequent drafts, you know, I began to work with this idea more deliberately, I think. But, you know, it seems to me that what I've come to believe is that escapism is not, you know, not merely it's not just a benefit of literature, which I think felt like a slightly radical thing to be saying about comic books, that what's good about them is that they're escapist and that's a positive thing. But also that's true for, at least for me, and I think for a lot of readers of all literature. I mean, I what I've come to understand is that I read to escape. It's not this kind of necessarily the simple kind of escape to, you know, the kind of Calgon, take me away kind of escape where you have this life that's pressing in on you and you've got all these stresses and so on, so you pick up a novel to just get away from your life. In that sense, it's much more about escaping from your own consciousness, escaping from your own, you know, the sort of tedium of your own thoughts, your own self, your own personality, the personality, the thoughts, and the self that you have to live with every day of your life. And to pick up a novel, especially a really good novel, a great novel, like Madame Bovary, is to escape from your own consciousness and to enter the consciousness of another human being, even though you understand that it's a fictitious human being. If the writer is doing a good job, then it's fully persuasive. And you get that sense of liberation from yourself. And I think that, you know, this is to me, that's the prime motive for reading, I think. But it's nothing that I really understood, you know, when I began working on this book.
I should here introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Michael Chabon, and his most recent novel is The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which won the Pulitzer Prize in the year 2000 and now has, for a couple of months now, it's been available in paperback. Picador USA is the publisher, and it's in the bookstore, and it's a good book. You might want to take a look at it. Questions, too, are welcome, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Apparently, there are some people who are really disappointed to hear that Sam Clay and Joe Cavalier were fictional characters, and they can't go out and read The Escapist. You, I understand, though, did spend, as part of the research for the book, spent time talking with people who were comic book artists to get some of the details of their lives and how they went about doing what they did. And it seems in sort of no accident that your characters, and in fact, many of these men, I guess they were men.
They were primarily, but not exclusively, Jewish. Yeah. Also primarily, but not exclusively. You know, I mean, this was something that I noticed very early on as I was doing the research. I had already known a lot about the history of comics, I guess, because I was a comics fan as a kid. And when I was reading comics, that was sort of in the early 1970s to mid-1970s. That's when a lot of the first real histories of comics were being written and published, and I read them and enjoyed them. So, you know, it was a kind of a rediscovery more than anything else. But as I was going through these histories and looking at the different guys that were involved in creating characters like Batman and Superman and Captain America and so on, you know, it became very apparent to me that a lot of them were Jewish guys, mainly from New York, although not necessarily all. And in fact, two most famous, Siegel and Shuster, the creators of Superman, were from Cleveland, Ohio. But you know, I just right away started wondering, well, what's that about? Why is that? Why would that have been so? And is there something about comic books that, about in particular the comic book superhero, that is somehow could be understood as Jewish in some way? And looking at Superman as sort of the first and foremost of all comic book superheroes, the answer immediately said, it seemed to me to be clear, yes, there are a lot of Jewish elements in Superman. And I'm far from the first person to have noticed them. Jules Pfeiffer has talked about it, and the poet Roger Kamenetz has wrote a whole poem about Superman the Jew. And so, I mean, you just, when you look at certain elements of that story, and then I started thinking about Jewish folklore, and sort of landed on this figure of the golem, the legendary automaton, who in many guises, but most popularly in his avatar as the Golem of Prague, was kind of a protector of the meek and defenseless and the innocent, and it just suddenly seemed to me that there was some kind of a Jewish basis for the comic book superhero. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, I don't want to overemphasize that. I think there was a lot of other stuff going into that as well, among which I would very heavily weight plagiarism, because I think a lot of the comic book superheroes were just kind of swipes from the pulp characters like Doc Savage and The Shadow and so on, and who were in their turn, you know, swiped from British penny novel kind of characters of the 19th century. So yeah, it's a complicated and fascinating history, and I really enjoyed doing the reading and conducting the interviews, talking to the guys like Will Eisner and Gil Kane that I talked to, and picking their brains.
Well, and it's as you pointed out earlier, I think as comic books have been vilified for about, I suppose, as long as there have been comic books, mm-hmm. they were condemned as, you know, they would destroy the minds and moralities of the youth of this nation and so forth. But I think something that's really clear in the way that you write about what it is that, particularly what Joe Cavalier does, is it seems that you have a real appreciation for the art, for comic art, and what one who really is good can do with that flat, two-dimensional form.
Absolutely. I mean, I think comics, it's disgraceful that American art lovers in general, whether they're lovers of whatever, you know, form they may be lovers of, have not acknowledged the power of comics. It's been proven now over and over again by great artists, from some of whom date from the kind of classic era that I'm writing about in my book, people like Will Eisner, the creator of The Spirit, others who grew up in underground comics, people like Robert Crumb and Art Spiegelman, to modern creators like Chris Ware, Chicago's own Chris Ware, and Dan Clowes, that comics are an inherently virtuous and powerful medium, and that in the hands of a genuine artist, comics can be as effective as any other medium. I mean, what matters really in a way is not so much the medium as the person who's manipulating it, whether it's in, you know, music or poetry or dance. And but for some reason, well, and I shouldn't say for some reason, I know why, because comics grew out of a publishing. They started out as a purely commercial form. They started out as a purely commercial form that was aimed at a very limited, in some ways, readership, namely children. Because of that, because of those origins, they've been penalized forever after by the sort of opinion makers in the art world, and that's been held against them and continues to be held against them. So that even today, I think, even though a comics lover has so much to be proud of. In comics that's been accomplished by, you know, truly fine artists, you still have a momentary kind of wince as you're talking to somebody about comics, or if you tell somebody that you like comics, it's, you try not to, but there's still this sort of inner twinge of realizing that what you're saying may, you know, sort of mark you as just hopelessly geeky. And you know, that's, it's not fair. Comics deserve better than that. They've proven it, as I said, over and over again. But, you know, it's just tough to, when you get that kind of bad rap laid on you as a kid, sometimes you just can never, you know, really outgrow it, no matter how hard you try.
Yeah. In the book, as we've explained, the fact that Joe Cavalier manages to get out of Czechoslovakia, he comes to the United States, and feels, because he knows his family is threatened, feels very frustrated. He feels powerless. He feels angry, and finds out his outlet for all of that is in the pages of the comics, where he has his hero, the escapist, battling Hitler.
Right.
And in fact, there's one description. I think it's the first cover. A wonderful description of a cover where the escapist is punching Hitler.
Right.
And one might, on the face of it, one might say, well, that sounds sort of fanciful. But, you know, I was looking through this book on comic history, and darn it, if I didn't come across a cover here of Captain America.
Yeah, first issue of Captain America.
He's punching Hitler, yeah. And it's just as very much like the one that you described. And, and I guess from that, I went on to realize that. And I think I also read it in some of the material about the book, that comic artists in the years before World War II really were dealing with these ideas, and that the comics went to war before the nation did.
Yes, that's very much the case. I mean, I think it was a combination of a couple of things. On the one hand, you had these young men, many of them Jewish, fairly, for the time, fairly well informed about what was going on, listening to the radio, getting the news, hearing what was happening in Europe and in the world, realizing, I think, like a lot of people, that there was something coming, that there, you know, after September 1st, 1939, there was a war going on in Europe. And really, especially for those who, you know, were Jews, feeling like they wanted to do something, that there must be something they could do, but of course there wasn't anything they could really do, and so they sort of did this in fantasy. On the other hand, what also was going on was that you had these characters that had been cooked up, some of them were, you know, vastly powerful, like Superman, and they needed, as it was quickly discovered by people who were trying to crank this stuff out every month, they needed somebody to fight. Somebody that was worthy of their, you know, a worthy opponent. Somebody that was not just like, you know, racketeers or card sharks or crooked union bosses or you know, people who are stealing pets or something. I mean, it took them a little while to hit on the supervillain, and I think part of the reason was because there was Adolf Hitler. Hmm. They didn't need to, and Hitler and the German war machine. And then sort of an ancillary or secondary way that the Japanese war machine and Tojo and people like that provided these just great enemies, these great villains that could be fought over and over and over again, because there was a sort of kind of Hydra-like quality that seemed to adhere to you know, to the German war machine, that if you, you know, you defeated them once, they would just be back again, even stronger the next time. And so, I mean, I think it was a combination of the exigencies of storytelling and a genuine desire to try to do something that, you know, led comics into the war more quickly than the rest of the country. And in a way, the Second World War really made comics. I mean, comic readership just exploded through the war years as not only children, but also GIs fighting overseas who were sent comics in their, you know, their ration kits along with, you know, chocolate and cigarettes and so on. That the comics just fed on the Second World War and grew fat on the Second World War. And when the Second World War ended, there was a kind of a little bit of a crisis as comics tried to find something else that was worthy of dealing with in their pages.
We have a caller here, somebody in Urbana on a cell phone, so let's do that. Here, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Interesting conversation. Can you recommend a compendium or a good read in the comic book genre that the people that I read novels with every week might find interesting and insightful?
Well, sure. I would recommend Chris Ware's most recent work, Jimmy Corrigan, Smartest Kid on Earth.
Okay.
It's beautifully drawn, beautifully constructed, beautifully written, and very haunting novel about a grown man and his memories of his own childhood. And I think adult readers would find it, you know, they do find it extremely satisfying, and it's much more than just a comic book.
Yeah, so is that W-A-R-E?
Yeah, yes.
Right.
W-A-R-E.
And what was the title again?
Jimmy Corrigan, Smartest Kid on Earth.
Right, okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. And other questions, comments are certainly welcome. We're talking with Michael Chabon. He's a novelist. His most recent book, the one we're talking about here this morning, is titled The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which is about the two cousins, Joe Cavalier and Sam Clay, who in the years before World War II come together and create comics and take part in the golden age of comics, and about how their lives play out during that time and after. It's published by Picador USA, won the Pulitzer Prize. He also has written Werewolves in Their Youth, Wonder Boys, which was made into a movie that a lot of people liked. I don't know.
Not quite enough.
Not quite enough, but I know a lot of people who...
They liked it a lot.
I know a lot of people who've seen the movie who said they thought it was very good. So at any rate, Wonder Boys, A Model World, and Other Stories, and The Mysteries of Pittsburgh. His home was in California. Maybe I'll mention one more time that he's going to be this weekend in Chicago for a couple of the events as part of the Chicago Humanities Festival. He'll be having a conversation with Jonathan Franzen at the Newberry Library Sunday, 11 o'clock in the morning. And then the same day, later in the afternoon, at 3:30 at Northwestern University, taking part in a panel discussion at the Thorne Library. So if you're in the Chicago area, you can take advantage of that. And questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Something else that I was very interested in, again, as I was looking at this book, about the history of comics, and this particular book is titled Comic Book Nation.
Oh, yeah.
By Bradford Wright.
Sure.
And I was just kind of looking at it. And something else that caught my eye was how, at least in some of the early years of these books, the political viewpoint was striking. I guess one of the things that I thought about was a Superman here, where one of the plots involved Superman rescuing some miners who are trapped, and he goes and rescues the miners, and the miners complain, well, the problem is the unsafe mine.
Right.
And Superman goes to the mine owner and, you know, says, hey, you know, what's the deal here? And the guy says, huh, I don't care about the miners, I just care about making money. And then Superman takes the boss, the big capitalist, and sticks him in the mine for a while. So he finds out what it's like, and then afterwards he says, gosh, you know, now that I know, I'll be a good guy from now on. And I guess I was really surprised by the political subtext of that.
Yeah, well, that is one of the more intriguing sort of, what would you call that? It's in a way, it's sort of a street that didn't go anywhere in comics. And in some respects, it might be an unfortunate that didn't go anywhere. What happened, I think, was the Second World War. There was a sort of brief moment after Superman's birth, and it was pretty much limited to Superman, I would say, where there was this attempt to conceive of the character of Superman as a kind of, as a champion of the oppressed, of a champion of the meek and the poor and the helpless. Somebody that was going to go to bat for the little guy, and this was 1938, so the Second World War, though brewing, was not yet upon us, and we were still very much mired in the Great Depression, and the idea of the common man, the little man, who needed protection against the big bosses, and so on, was still very current, very widely subscribed to by very many people, and Superman coming first, being the first, I think, grew out of that impulse as much as of any other. But really, as I said, that was kind of it. And after that, other things began to intrude and encroach, and the national mood began to change, and that kind of disappeared, I think. And in a way, has never really come back again. That idea of the superhero. I mean, superheroes after the Second World War got caught up in fighting supervillains like Lex Luthor and so on, and the Joker, the idea of the superhero as a kind of messiah of ordinary people, I think, has kind of been left relatively unexplored.
Mm. It seems now that what interests us, and this is no great revelation on insight on my part because so much has been written about it, but the fact that when you look at these characters, you don't have to look very far to see that in many of them, in some way or ways, are fundamentally warped. They have very strange aspects to their character, very, very dark sides that now maybe, again, sort of because where we are postmodern-wise, now is the thing that interests us, and writers have dealt with more, and now more comics that have been created in recent years, some of them reinterpreting older characters or creating newer characters, really smack you in the face with the dark side of the characters.
Yeah, the superhero turned very dark in the mid-1980s, primarily because of two very fine works. One novel, sort of graphic novel, called The Dark Knight Returns by Frank Miller that dealt with Batman, and then another called The Watchmen that dealt with a sort of created for the purposes group of superhero figures, but who had a lot of echoes of well-known and established superheroes, and they both really did explore that very dark, emotionally sort of crippled, almost fascistic element, clearly fascistic element in the superhero idea, and the idea of these sort of like self-appointed, physically super powerful vigilantes imposing their own code on the rest of society. I think that was sort of laid bare by Alan Moore in The Watchmen and Frank Miller in The Dark Knight Returns, and sort of unfortunately it was so compelling that a lot of other people kind of jumped in to do the same thing with every other character that was ever created, so that you had, Captain Marvel, even the sort of the sunniest, most smiling superhero ever created. Even he kind of had to take on this sort of this mantle of neurotic obsession and frustration. It got a little ridiculous. I think there was a certain amount of the art form sort of eating itself going on, and that proved to be not very healthy in the long run. In a way, there has been a kind of reaction against that now in comics, so that even some of the people who perpetrated those works, which are, like I said, very, very great in their own way, have kind of gone back to a somewhat sunnier view of the whole comic book genre. Mm.
I suppose these things do go in cycles. Mm-hmm. I think, though, it's interesting that we should, on the one hand, continue to find these kinds of characters very appealing for their wish fulfillment and for the kid in all of us who would like to have superpowers, because we, you know, when things are bad, you start thinking, wouldn't it be great if somebody would come along and save us? And at the
right.
same time, we can't quite bring ourselves to believe in that. I mean, we want to.
Well,
there's great
I think
appeal
right.
to
it. I mean, and one of the things I've heard a lot in the wake of September 11th is a lot of people have said to me, you know, I just kept thinking, where's Superman? Hmm. That if there really were Superman, that would have been, you know, the time for one to appear. And, you know, I think people, there is that, you do have that wish of somebody help me. That there's, it is a deep wish. And on the other hand, of course, you know that it's totally futile and that, you know, there's no real possibility of that. That film, what was it called? Unbreakable. I don't know if, you know, how many people saw that film, but it kind of dealt with the same issue of just that longing, that wish that there could be such a person, and the sort of the forlornness of that wish.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's also it is something I think probably that that your characters in the book do deal with, and have some sense, feel maybe a little bit conflicted that
absolutely,
here,
especially Joe Cavalier.
Yes,
he realizes in a way that I don't think Sammy ever does that there is this fascistic element. There is this. This glorification of physical strength and violence as a way of solving problems, of imposing one's will on other people, even if those other people are, you know, apparently or quite clearly evil, that is not right. And there's a moment that Joe has where he wonders whether, you know, in his he has sort of gone through this orgy of wish fulfillment of just slaughtering the Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe and the SS over and over again in the pages of comic books as his family situation in Prague is getting more and more desperate and his desire to do something is getting more and more intense. He just continues to ratchet up the level of violence in the comic books that he's drawing to levels that I might add are just exactly those of actual comics of the time. I didn't exaggerate that kind of violence at all. And then he has this moment where he wonders, is all I'm doing and having my superpower guy pounding the daylights out of these guys over and over again, am I just sort of guaranteeing the creation of another generation of people who believe that that is the way that these kind of problems can be solved? You know, he is troubled by that, and I don't think that was necessarily widespread among comic book creators of the time, but it was present, and even people like Will Eisner, you know, sort of worried about that, or at least the thought crossed their mind that what they were doing was sort of partaking in creating the superhero. They were sort of partaking of the same kind of thinking that led to, you know, Nazi ideas like the, you know, the Übermensch and the master race.
Mm. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Michael Chabon talking about his book, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. It is a novel. It's been out now in paper for a couple of months, and you might look for it in the bookstore. Questions also welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Back in the beginning, we talked a little bit about the fact that the two cousins create this character, the escapist, who has this amazing ability to escape, and that is partly inspired by Houdini and also by Joe Cavalier's childhood or youthful interest in magic and escape. And I went on to make this observation about how this theme runs, this idea escape, liberation runs all the way through. And you said something I thought was very interesting, that it was only after perhaps doing some initial writing on the book that you saw
right.
that. And, you know, I would have thought, This is one of your, you know, naive non-writer kind of things. You would have thought that, well, this guy sat down and he said, you know, I think I'd kind of like to write a book exploring the idea of, you know, and I thought it to me, it's very interesting to know that, you know, you started out wanting to tell a particular kind of story and these facets emerged that then you thought, well, that's very interesting. Look at this. And then worked more with them. What did the book start out as, or what was it that you at the beginning kind of thought you'd like to do?
It was really, you know, I guess it all goes out of my own childhood, in the sense that I'm among the people who have a parent who grew up in Brooklyn, New York in the 1930s. And as anybody who's in the same class as me knows, those people tend to be very, very talkative about their own childhoods, very nostalgic toward their childhoods in Brooklyn, and in, let's just expand it to include all of New York in the 1930s, and that the memories from that time seem to the people who have them to be especially rich and poignant. And my father liked to talk about his childhood, and I liked to hear about it, and I used to ask him questions. And I got very interested as a kid, as a result of that, in the world of New York in the 1930s and 40s, and of America as a whole, the popular culture of the time, from the comic books to the movies, the music, and also the history of the time, the history of the Second World War, the history of the Roosevelts, and the Depression years, and all of that's just always been fascinating to me. I think because, in large part, because of my father, and because of this wish that I'd always had, that I could somehow have been there, had seen it for myself, have known what it was like, and the desire to write this novel really grew out of that desire just to go back in time and to see for myself this period that I felt so close to, and yet was, you know, it was so removed from, and that I would never really be able to see. And so I conceived of the novel, I think, initially as just a kind of a time travel machine, a time machine to take me back to this period. I needed a way into that world that was a central position in New York of the period, and yet would also be one that had not been written about too much before. I didn't want to feel like I was trotting over the same ground as other writers, and it just one day I hit on this comics idea, having grown up as a reader of comic books, as the perfect vehicle to get me into that world, because nobody had ever really done it before, but it was very much at the heart of all the kind of stuff that was swirling around in the air in this period that I wanted to write about. So I just started with that desire to kind of go back in time, then kind of fairly quickly conceived my two main characters, and took it from there. And I don't ever start with theme or themes with a thematic concern. I can't imagine doing that. And in fact, to be totally honest, I don't give theme a second thought when I'm conceiving a novel, when I'm working on the first draft of the novel. It's the last thing that I think about. I'm paying far too much attention to trying to get my characters to breathe, to feel real, to come to life, and to trying to create the world that they're living in, and then of course, to tell a story, a compelling, interesting story. And what I do is just trust that if I'm doing all of those things, if I'm paying attention to my characters and their setting and the action of my story, that theme will emerge on its own through some mysterious process that I don't understand very well, it typically does happen. And then looking over the first draft, as I said, then you can you put on your sort of your critical hat and you analyze it the way you've been taught to analyze things as an English major, and you say, well, what are the themes of this work? What do I see emerging as themes? And they're always there, and you just haven't really noticed them. And then normally what you need to do at that point is to really bring them out and emphasize them, because you haven't been paying enough attention to theme. And I'm not trying to say theme is not important. I'm just trying to say that it's not important to me when I'm beginning work on a novel.
As I sort of near the beginning of the conversation, I think that there are some people that are really disappointed to learn that your characters are fictional characters.
I love hearing that.
They're not real guys.
One of my goals.
And I don't know if this is too, it's too technical a question, but. And I think that you certainly have been very successful at creating characters that seem and feel real.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What is the key to that, do you think?
Well, I wish I could sum it up quickly, but I mean, I think it's a combination, especially with regard to this book. There's just something you need to do when you're trying to write about fictional characters, which is to really see them yourself as a writer. I mean, to see them in your mind's eye, to see them and to also to hear them and to on occasion be aware of the smells that are around them you have to have this very clear, I don't, a mental just doesn't quite feel like the right word, but I'll just say mental for want of a better word, a mental image of them, and to have your mind on them, to really be imagining them, I guess is what I'm talking about. And the more fully you can imagine them and sort of then transcribe what you're imagining, the more real they're going to seem to, you know, a reader. You know, I don't exactly know how I do that, but I just, it is just ultimately about imagination. I often think of it, there's a story about acting with Sir Laurence Olivier where he supposedly said to Dustin Hoffman, when he saw Hoffman making all these efforts at doing it by the method with, you know, not eating and not shaving and not sleeping to try to get himself into the proper state of mind. And Laurence Olivier said, you know, have you ever considered trying acting? And it's a little bit like that with writing, and that, I mean, it's ultimately, it is a kind of a, and not act in that sense, but it's about just using your imagination more than anything else, more than research, more than having lived some kind of rich Hemingway-esque life of animal hunting and being an ambulance driver in World War One. You know, if you have the imagination, that's really the main thing that you need. But then in this book, I also did employ some tricks like footnotes and sort of pseudo-scholarly references, and I tried to blend and blur the boundaries between quote-unquote reality and the fiction of my book by, you know, mentioning real-life people, having real-life people appear in the novel, and also having, you know, saying things about my characters that implied that if you wanted to, you could go buy this book or go look them up in the library and they would be there. And I did try to sort of make it even fuzzier than usual, the line between the world of my book and the so-called real world.
Hmm. How long did it take you to write, and how many major revisions do you think there were?
Oh, it took me 4 years, 4 months, and 4 days. And I guess I wrote about 5 drafts altogether.
Hmm.
Some of them more complete rewrites than others. And I guess toward the end they got to be less, more like polishes than anything else.
Well, what are you working on now?
I'm writing a novel for children. It's called Summerland. It's aimed at middle readers, say, you know, 9, 10, 11-year-old readers. It's kind of a contemporary fantasy. It takes place against a backdrop of American mythology and legend, and has a lot of baseball in it as well. I'm really very much enjoying writing that. And then I'm also working on the screenplay of Cavalier and Clay, which I'm on, about to begin the 4th draft of. And that's actually looking okay right now, and I'm somewhat hopeful that there may actually be a film as a result of all of this.
So there's no director or anything like that attached to this?
No, director. There's just the producer, Scott Rudin, who also produced Wonder Boys and me at this point.
Well, I want to say thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Oh, and, thank you, David. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, well, and I certainly enjoyed Cavalier and Clay very much.
Oh, thank you.
I thought it was terrific. Well, so we appreciate you giving us your time.
My pleasure.
Our guest this morning, Michael Chabon. And if you look for his book, by the way, his last name is spelled Chabon. The book is The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. Won the Pulitzer Prize in 2000. They don't give those to just anybody. Have to be pretty good. As published by Picador USA, is in bookstore now. And I'll mention one more time, coming up this weekend, he will be in Chicago as part of the Chicago Humanities Festival, Sunday, 11 a.m. at the Newberry Library, a conversation with Jonathan Franzen, and then at the Thorne Library in a panel discussion at Northwestern, same day, Chicago Humanities Festival, November 11th, Sunday, 3:30 in the afternoon.